Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Avi, and I am truly excited to host this conversation and so honored to be welcoming a new friend, Dr. Tina Sellers, and also to be joined by my friend and frequent collaborator,
Nicolina Duas-Isima.
And today, we will be having our part one of two conversations about cultivating pleasure and healthy sexuality. Dr. Tina is a licensed family and sex therapist, researcher, speaker, and a leading voice on the impact of shame on sexual health. She's also the founder and medical director of the Northwest Institute on Intimacy, which provides training and supervision for therapists, medical providers, and clergy in sexual health and confronting sexual bias. Dr. Tina is also the best-selling author of Shameless Parenting, Everything You Need to Raise Shame-Free, Confident Kids and Heal Your Shame Too. And for those of you who might not know my frequent partner in crime, Nicolina, she's a top dream expert based in the Netherlands who helps people from all walks of life reach breakthroughs by making sense of their dreams and nightmares. She's also a member of the International Association for the Study of Dreams and an author and speaker. She's extremely interested in the intersection of our dream world and our sexuality, so I'm really happy to have her insights here with us as well. Okay, let's get started. Sexuality is an integral and cherished part of our human experience. It is a complex phenomenon with physical, emotional, intellectual, social, and spiritual dimensions. So I would love to start, Dr. Tina, by defining sexuality, especially the way in which we will be referring to it today. How do you define sexuality and how do you see its role in our lives?
I love that we're going to begin here with this question, Avi. And I actually want to invite everybody to just wonder about that question themselves. How would you define sexuality? It's not a question that most of us have been asked in our lives. So I actually just love this question. And I taught human sexuality at the graduate level for 30 years, and I teach it now at the postgraduate level. And I'll often ask people to take time to just think about that question. How do we define sexuality? How do we define sex? Because I just think it's such a fascinating question. The way that I define it is I think of it as our erotic life force as a person. And the word eros actually is an old Greek word, and it means the coming together of body and soul, born of chaos and personifying creative power and harmony. It's our capacity for joy. It can involve the body, senses, desire, the heart, trust with another. It can have aesthetic beauty and ecstasy, and thus it can facilitate connection, pleasure, joy, catharsis, and transformation. But it does not need to, and it does not always. Sexuality does not neatly fit in any boxes. But one of the things that we've come to know is that when coercion and manipulation is involved, sexual trauma will be inflicted. And what we have seen clinically is that when there is a sexual wound, there has been a wound to the soul. So that takes us back to that Greek word eros, the coming together of body and soul. There was a definition by a surgeon general back in 2001 where he said, sexuality is an integral part of human life. It carries the awesome power to create new life. It can foster intimacy and bonding, as well as shared pleasure in our relationships. Sexual health is intricately bound to both physical and mental health. And I thought that was an interesting definition coming from somebody really outside the field, really in the medical field, which often doesn't recognize the totality of sexuality and the human experience. that's where I locate myself in thinking about sexuality. And as far as the roles that it plays in our lives, I think of it really as having three different primary roles. The first one, it helps us connect to ourselves and our desire for joy, comfort, and pleasure. And if you hang around little ones, you really see this naturally emerge in children, really as soon as almost a year old when they find their genitals. And this is before they've been able to absorb any of the adults around them, their feelings about it. And if they're in a home where somebody is really uncomfortable with them finding their genitals, eventually they will absorb that adult's feeling of shame. But initially, they don't have any of those feelings, and they have just discovered their genitals, which have enormous amounts of nerve endings, 8,000 in the clitoris and up to 5,000 in the head of the penis. And they're pretty excited about that. And so there's this natural joy. They find comfort in touching that part of their body, and there's pleasure there. And you just see how naturally this is how we are wired. We are wired for that joy. We are wired for that seeking of comfort and that seeking of pleasure. So that is part of a primary role of our sexuality. And two, I think of it as, for many people, and certainly not all people, it's part of our desire to connect in pleasure with an other. And that's part of the role that sexuality plays. And really, least often, but certainly important, sexuality is part of what we do to procreate. So those are really the three primary roles that sexuality plays in our life. First to ourselves, and then perhaps with another, and then maybe to procreate.
I love that, Dr. Tina. And thank you for being so thorough on the definition, because I always love to start with definitions. And the thing that always surprises me is that most of us don't associate the term sexuality in terms of a connection to ourselves. It feels like it's always a connection to the other. And I love that you mentioned that, and hopefully we can talk about that a little bit more as we take on these other questions. And so a question arises about why most of us don't have a healthy relationship with our sexuality. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wonder if it would be worthwhile to talk about what it means to have a healthy relationship with our sexuality. What does that look like? Because maybe that gives us a place to say, what would be unhealthy? Where am I in relationship to unhealth, depending on where I grew up? Was it in the United States, or was it in another country or somewhere else? So when I think about healthy sexuality, I really see three things. First, seeing you and your body as worthy of love, joy, comfort, connection, and pleasure. And like I just said, we start out that way. If nobody gets in our way, we're going to keep going that way. Yeah, I deserve love and joy and comfort and connection and pleasure. I come out of the womb, and right away, a little baby is rooting, turning their head and seeking connection and pleasure. So we know that very core to who we are, that's core in our sexuality, in our eros. But beyond that, it also means that we're willing to know our own body, its likes, its pleasures, its particularities. And this might mean for some of us that we need to do some learning and unlearning, perhaps, about sex and relationships, depending on where we grew up. So the degree to which we have drifted away from where we started as little children, we might need to do some more learning about what is the truth about my body and what I like and what I don't like against what I have been taught from the culture that I grew up in. It also means that you're willing, once you've discovered what you particularly in your own way, because it's a broad world out there about what different people like and don't like and what feels good to them and what doesn't. It also means that once you've figured that out, that you are willing to speak up for yourself if you decide to share your own particular likes and dislikes with somebody else, that you're willing to speak up for yourself with people who want to honor you and be curious with you and will enjoy that discovery with you. So that becomes another third part of it, that you want to be in relationship with people who will find that journey fun and enjoyable with you, and that you'll feel comfortable to speak up for yourself. So I really think of those three aspects as part of a healthy relationship with our own sexuality. So you ask the question, why don't most people, especially in the US, have a healthy relationship with our sexuality? So we are all, no matter where we grew up, we are all shaped by our environment, by our families of origin, by our ethnicities, by our culture, by whatever religion might have informed our families, by our society's values and norms, by our experiences, our particular experiences, whether they're positive or negative. And that mixes with our own particular personality bent that we have in our DNA, that we got passed down genetically and epigenetically from our particular family and genetics. So we might be anxious or earnest or shy or empathic or perfectionistic or detailed or cautious or super adventurous or laid back or whatever. We all have our different personality bents. Those things mix together like a recipe in us. I grew up in a Swedish immigrant family, and I am pretty determined. I grew up very athletic and pretty easygoing as a kid. So my family, ethnically and culturally, was very body and sex positive, as many Northern European cultural families can be. So I happened to be taught about bodies and sexuality throughout my growing up by all of my family members. I wasn't ever shamed that I can remember for finding my genitals at age one or pleasuring myself at age three or by being curious about somebody else's body at age five or any of the other things that naturally happen along the way. And I could fill this whole talk by telling you funny stories of things that I did or things that my parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles said to me along the way growing up. And I actually thought it all was pretty normal. They just explained things pretty matter of fact along the way as I went along. And I thought it was normal, but it really wasn't. And I didn't learn that it wasn't normal until I was probably in my 30s. So that's how my family was growing up. But I can talk about how that was very different from about 95% of people who grew up in the United States.
Talk about cultural differences. I grew up in the Netherlands in the 80s, and that was a time that feminism and sexual freedom was all over the place. If a movie didn't have some full frontal male nudity, it wasn't really considered a movie for normal adult people. We were joking as kids at the unnecessariness of, where we're like, okay, we get it. Sex is normal. Could we please get all the penises out of our face? But at the same time, in a time of all of that openness, and I really liked it, by the way, I really liked that we normalized the human body as a culture in the Netherlands without sexualizing it, but just telling people, hey, this is a body that you have and that's amazing. Now let's see what you can do with it. But here's the thing. I personally grew up in a family where that wasn't really the case. My parents had a difficult relationship, both of them, with sexuality. My mom had a horrible childhood and didn't like to be touched. I don't think I've ever seen my parents share a kiss together or even touch each other in a very loving way that is even remotely sexual. So I had this sort of contrast in myself. On the one hand, completely open. Like, I went to art school. We just painted naked bodies all day just to see what the body looks like. And everybody was fine with it. There was absolutely nothing tensional about it. I grew up with this idea that as a woman, my body is my own and I can enjoy it if I wanna. But at the same time, I also grew up with this idea that there is a deep, disturbing pain when it comes to sex. So I had to really find my way in that.
Wow, this is so wonderful. I think for the audience to hear how complex sexuality can be in that mixture of your family of origin experience and your cultural experience and all the different things that go and mix into your own story and who you are and what you're able to pay attention to, how that mixes with your own personality. My little sister, who obviously grew up in the same family, she married someone who's Dutch and who immigrated to the United States as an adult. And his experience was a very sex positive culture. And it fit so neatly with her background because his home was pretty sex positive as well, that raising their children was just super easy for them because it just fit like a lock and a key together. What I ended up teaching at a marriage and family therapy program on a religious university, although the graduate school was not necessarily religious, but I taught human sexuality and I had my students write their sexual autobiography in that class. Now, you might think, why in the world would I ever have students do such a thing? They were all becoming therapists. And I'm a firm believer that you're only ever as good a therapist as where you begin and end your story, where your clients begin and end. And part of that is learning what all of the significant stories of your life are. Well, your sexual story is a very significant story as far as shaping you. And yet, in a country like the United States that does not have comprehensive sex education like the Netherlands does, and Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Finland, et cetera, and we've had only abstinence-only education since 1980, our sexual stories often live inside of us in these tiny snippets of experience that we remember. Oh, I remember getting in trouble for playing doctor with my cousin when I was 5. Or I remember my first kiss, or I remember this experience. So it's not a cohesive narrative. So I had them write their story. I gave them 70 or 80 questions just as a way to create prompts for them to just write so they could develop a cohesive narrative.
70 or 80 questions? I didn't even know there were that many questions you could think of.
I noticed that seemed crazy. But yeah, I would have them think back into their family, their 3 generations. So I would say, where did ideas of gender come down? Where did ideas of affection come down? Who could talk to who couldn't talk to who? Just all kinds of different questions. And then I would walk them through their childhood asking different things and their adolescence asking different things and their adulthood asking different things. So really thinking about it through a kaleidoscope of questions. The questions were just there as prompts to jog their memory, because when you don't have a cohesive narrative in your mind, you don't know where to start. So prompts can be helpful in making you dig up stories that are laying dormant in the back of your mind. I read in my career over 600 of these. And what I learned, which was the shocking part for me, that well over 90 to 95% of people who grew up in the U.S. grew up in families that were silent or silent and shaming around sexuality. So the normal sexual development that people do, the things that people are curious about at 2 and 4 and 6 and 8 and 10 and 12 and 14 and 16 and 18, all the things that you just normally develop and become curious and desiring to do and explore, etc., they didn't have anybody in their home that was helpful to them. And if anybody was there to do anything, it was really to shame them around that. And so most people would say if they got anything, they got in trouble and they got most of their information from the media and from friends. So this comes from a really long history in the United States of family histories. So it's passed down from parents, from grandparents to parents and from great grandparents. It's passed all the way down. And for many somewhere in there, it's seeped in some form of Western religious ideology and politics. So somewhere in there, you often see some kind of Western form of Christianity that says no sex before marriage. And if there's been any conservative form of Western Christianity, it could be as much as don't think about sex, don't desire sex, don't talk about it, don't feel it, depending on the degree of the conservative ideology that may have been around. There was a big wave of conservative ideology that began in the 80s and peaked in the 90s that we've come to call the purity movement. So sex was seen as super dangerous in the last 40 years in the United States. But what was happening simultaneously and has been happening simultaneously is that the U.S. also commercializes and commodifies fantasy female and male bodies, certain types of sex, certain types of genders, and violence and humiliation against women, while vilifying other types of bodies, sexualities, and ways of being. These things are coming at us. These messages are coming at us over and over and over and over again, and they drive our economy, and they are constant, and they profoundly affect our self-esteem because we internalize them as true. So they're subtle, they're constant, and they have a profound effect on us. So I just want to highlight that because sometimes we can't see them because it's the water that we're swimming in. So I'll stop with that, but that's part of what creates for us a difficult sexual health.
Thank you for that, Dr. Tina. As you were speaking about this influence becomes so seamless into our lives that we don't even notice it, I'm wondering how this compares and contrasts with the other countries that you were talking about, or the Netherlands, where the attitude is so different. What is happening in those countries as it relates to bigger cultural influence and the media?
I love that question. First, I want to say no country is perfect, because that would mean that there would have to be humans that are perfect, and that's an oxymoron, right? Because humans aren't. I always like to say humans are radically valuable and radically imperfect. That's just the nature of who we are. But in those countries that have comprehensive sex education, it begins in preschool, runs all the way through high school or to 18. It's age appropriate. And so kids are learning body autonomy, where their body begins and another person's body begins and ends, how you ask before you touch somebody, what a good friend is. That's really the beginning of learning consent. They learn about the value of themselves, the value of other people, why kindness is important, why respect is important. All those kinds of emotional intelligence kinds of things they are learning right from the very beginning. Those are the things that they learn in elementary school. So it's really relational intelligence, emotional intelligence. And then as they get in later elementary school, they begin to learn about the deeper intricacies of anatomy and physiology and reproduction, and then into intimate relationship as they move into junior high and high school. So it's very age appropriate. It matches what they are naturally curious about and naturally would want to know about. And they're free to ask all the questions that naturally emerge for them. So it just fits for them. There's a really wonderful book called Not Under My Roof by Amy Shallet, S-C-H-A-L-E-T. And Amy grew up in Holland, in the Netherlands, and she came to the United States to do some academic work. And she was immediately struck by how odd the adolescents were in relationship to their sexuality in comparison to where she grew up. And so she decided to do some doctoral dissertation work interviewing families in the United States in two different towns and then pick two towns in the Netherlands and interview families there, kids and the adults, the parents, around how they do sexuality. And she put it in this book. And she and I were both speaking at a conference at Harvard Medical School. And I was so delighted by her work because it was what I had experienced. It was my childhood, like the Netherlands, against what she had experienced in the United States, is what I had seen in my students. The kids in the Netherlands actually would talk to their parents about their sexual readiness. And they often had their first sexual experiences at home, where the kids in the United States did not talk to their parents past age 8 or 9. And they had their first sexual experiences often in cars or in some place that would not be necessarily very comfortable or enjoyable. And their first sexual experiences often weren't necessarily positive. And this is because their parents weren't necessarily resources for them, because the parents didn't know how to be, because no one had helped them along the way. So this is part of what ends up happening in this process. If you have comprehensive sex education along the way, you as a child have some sense of comfortability about it so that you can engage in these conversations with your kids, where so many Americans, all they have is shame and they don't have the words inside of them because they just had silence. So what we know about the European countries is that every single measure, teen pregnancy, STI rates, they get involved with sex later, they make safer sexual choices, their first sexual experiences are better, they tend to pair with people who fit them better, they describe their sexual lives as more satisfying and more varied. Every single measure that you would do research around is more positive in these different countries than in ours. So that's some of what's different.
Yes, I grew up in the Netherlands. Just to say, this woman's speaking truth. I'm now in my mid-40s, but when I grew up, and I was a late bloomer, but this was not unusual. What happened to me and my boyfriend when we were at the later years of high school, and we had sex for the first time at his parents' place in his bedroom. His mom got us the condoms, so sweet. She just had put them out there because they were all very aware of what was going to happen. And we thought that was really normal. And we were a little bit scared that one time that we forgot about condoms. So now the natural thing for us to do was to go to my parents, because this happened in my house, and to confess what we'd done, and that now we were scared and we didn't know what to do. So my dad said, I'll drive you to get a morning after pill. Obviously, don't worry about it. This is going to be fine. The teen pregnancy rate in the Netherlands is the lowest in any other country that I've ever seen, because we think this is completely normal to talk to our parents about. Now, don't get me wrong. We're not discussing details. I'm not discussing with my girlfriends about whether or not we watch porn or something. This is still a private topic, but it's not a topic that is impossible to discuss, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Just the idea that your first experience would be at home and that someone's parents would be providing condoms is just such a foreign way of thinking about it versus here. And the question that arose for me, Dr. Tina, is there a difference in the age of those who are in these countries in terms of the initial stage where kids start to have sex versus in the US or other countries where this is not the case?
We find that kids are having sex somewhere between 16 and 18, typically. And that's true in most industrialized countries that we can tell. It doesn't vary gigantically, but what is different is you don't see the shame and kids having good first experiences with people that they care about and who care about them in these countries that have comprehensive sex education. So you're not hearing about hookups as much or feeling used or having bad experiences as much in these countries that have comprehensive sex education, where in our country, you hear much more of kids having bad first experiences, wanting to get it over with because they haven't had sex, but they feel like everybody else has. So they just do it to do it. Or kids having sex without contraception because they can't tell anybody or they can't tell their parents. In our more conservative states right now, we only have 18 states in the United States right now that require medically accurate sex education. So all the rest, the sex education does not have to be medically accurate. And so in our more conservative states, we have higher rates of teen pregnancies and STIs and higher rates of kids not using contraception. And it's because they're afraid of getting in trouble. So what I want to underscore here is the impact of shame on someone's life. So when you don't feel shame, when you realize you're just growing up normal and this is good and your sexuality is good and learning is good, and even if you have a mistake, that's an opportunity to learn. You feel like you're okay. You're okay as a person. I'm good. But when you feel shame for being who you are, which is what shame is, then you begin to feel inside that something is fundamentally wrong with you. So when you begin to get shamed at 2 for finding your genitals and sitting on the couch and playing with your penis or your vulva, and then somebody yells at you and you get yelled at again and you get yelled at again and you get yelled at in the bath and then you get yelled at again. And then that happens again at 5, and you continue to get shamed for everything you do related to your body. You begin to believe that something is fundamentally wrong with this impulse, this part of you, this erotic part of you. And that shapes your core self-esteem because it is who you are. Your sexuality is part of who you are, a deep, meaningful, soulful part of who you are. So it shapes how you give love and receive love, because you fundamentally believe if people knew who I really am, they couldn't possibly love me because inside I'm damaged, I'm bad, because I've been told this in various ways since I was a toddler. So this is really what I want to say is fundamentally different in these countries. Is that one set of countries is never giving that message. It's just always saying, you're fine. Who you are is fine. You're fine. And the other one is saying over and over again, who you are is not fine. Who you are is bad, and you should not be that. But you can't figure out what part of you you're not supposed to be because you're just being you.
The other thing that really stuck with me about exploring your body with somebody else from a place of curiosity is, even if one of the two people has a healthy relationship, if the other person doesn't, then that connection isn't possible. So it's preventing us from engaging, because those of us who might have the comfortable relationship with sexuality are not going to be able to partner up with people who don't. So it could be killing relationships before it even starts.
You're absolutely right. And I have counseled people who are doing their own work around healing their shame. If you're in relationship with somebody who has a lot of sexual shame, often what they're doing is they're projecting their self-hatred onto you versus just functioning from a place of self-hatred. So there's a lot of anger. There can be a lot of just projections that are really painful after the relationship gets going for 6 months or a year, and it won't be at the beginning. So it's really important that you are with somebody who recognizes, like, okay, this is how my childhood was. It was not affirming of bodies and sexuality. And so therefore, I am doing this work to get to a place where I can celebrate myself and celebrate my body and sexuality as a good and lovely and wonderful part of being human. And you're in it together. You're in the healing process together, because it often is very difficult to be in relationship with somebody who fundamentally believes that they're not okay. And there are a lot of people where that's the truth for them. Yeah.
I'd love to add to what you just said about projecting maybe as anger, this shame. I'm also noticing that anxiety, even if it's not projecting, comes in a lot. And I'm very much noticing that in the way people come to me, quietly whispering that they had this really weird sex dream and they're so anxious about it. And what does it mean? And does it mean that I secretly want this? So I'm noticing that even if we don't project, there can still be so much anxiety around it.
Yeah, that's so good, Nicolina. And as you guys were talking, I was also thinking that there's so many nuances and how it can creep into our lives or ways of being in the most seemingly trivial ways. All these little ways that it's seeping into our inner world without our realization, which is also really crazy.
Both of you bring up really good points. These things are deep in our subconscious. They're often deep in our story too. So I often say that in the United States, I believe that our first shame is often sexual shame, because many times when we have been shamed, it's pre-verbal. We're getting our diapers changed. We're 10 months old. We now have control over our hand. We know how to reach for things and we find our genitals. And that's exciting. And we can start to put our hand there on purpose. There are not very many people in the United States that when these little ones find their genitals on purpose and are excited about that, they have a caregiver right there who is saying, yep, that's your clitoris, sweetheart. Yep, it's a wonderful part of you. Now let's move your hand and finish diapering. The vast majority of people have somebody saying, ooh, yuck, that's yucky, and then slaps their hand away. That's the experience of most people. Now, that's a pre-verbal experience, and that doesn't happen just once. That happens many times. The child doesn't stop doing that. They don't stop having those experiences until they're maybe five, and then they're getting in trouble playing doctor, and then that memory sticks. That all translates into some unconscious pre-verbal something that might come out much later in their lives.
Dr. Tina, this has been so eye-opening. And I think we now have a much better sense of how we ended up here with these unhealthy relationships to our own sexuality. So maybe we will leave it here for today and come back for part two, where we will be talking about how to cultivate a healthier relationship with our sexuality and with pleasure. So I'm going to be really looking forward to that. Thank you, Dr. Tina. Thank you, Nicolina. And thank you to this beautiful audience. I hope this has been eye-opening for you as well. And we look forward to seeing you for part two. Have a beautiful morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are in the world. Bye, everyone.